on what we can get together.
Yes.
The peg will be the fact that for anybody who missed The Thirsty Muse when it came out in hardcover, it's now.
Yes, yes. I did a lot of this back in London in February. I was running around for a week doing all this kind of stuff. I didn't see a copy of that publicity thing that you got there.
You're not supposed to get it.
I'm not. Why not? The author should get it.
That's the way publishers work. Yes. The author is always the last to know about these things. But that's the way it goes. But anyway, I was fascinated by your book. And how did you get interested in this topic?
I was teaching a course in American literature down at the World Trade Center. And one of my not-too-bright students one day asked me, Professor Dardis, how come all the writers we read in this course are alkies? How come? And I found I really didn't have an answer, and I felt there was a book in this. And that's the book.
Is that statement true?
Yes, all of the major American writers in this century, with very few exceptions, American writers, have been, in fact, alcoholics. Whether it's Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, probably Theodore Dreiser, God knows, Hart Crane, Eugene O'Neill. There are almost no exceptions. In other words, writing, if you have literary talent, it seems as one of the labor problems connected with it, you have to drink.
I'm going to get you just a little closer.
Sure.
But that's extraordinary. But you're talking about the cream of the crop.
The creme de la creme, yes, yes. I could add some more names, John Cheever, for example, Truman Capote, who was hospitalized 22 times in the last 18 months of his life. Tennessee Williams. There are almost no exceptions.
Raymond Carver, I believe you mentioned.
Raymond Carver. Raymond Chandler, Dashiell Hammett, both of them. No matter whether it's plays, detective stories, serious fiction, poets, or whatever have you, it is the American writer's disease, and has been so in this century.
That's extraordinary. Mm-hmm. Now, you said almost without exception, but are there any exceptions?
Yes, I can think of a few exceptions. Most of the better women writers, for example, Edith Wharton, Flannery O'Connor, it seems to be a masculine prerogative that men do this. Now, of course, you may say, well, that's history, that the women have not been drinking as long as the men have, and they are surely catching up. The fact is that women's cancer rates in smoking are increasing rapidly, and they started smoking late, so presumably the same thing is going to happen to women. But by and large, most of the major American women writers have not been alcoholic.
Oh, but there's Dorothy Parker, I believe.
Dorothy Parker was, yes, she was. Definitely, no doubt about that. Jean Stafford was an alcoholic, for example. Juno Barnes. They have their toll, but not as many, at anywhere near the same degree as the men.
Why is this profession, why does this profession seem to spawn alcoholics?
Well, I give two basic reasons. First of all, the whole background of the book is the genetic factor. Is now considered opinion that most medical authorities that there is a genetic component to alcoholism. That's for starters. But the whole point is that back in the 20s, and of course in the early 30s, it was considered to be a writer's, how can I put it, duty to drink heavily, because thereby you're essentially thwarting authority and you're expressing yourself, and essentially, more importantly, you're coming into contact with your genius. In other words, something goes all the way back to Horace. In other words, he or she who drinks wine freely will be in touch with their muse, hence my title, The Thirsty Muse. In other words, to get really in touch with creativity, drink. It's a liberating factor. Of course, it's also a deadening factor, too, but the writers didn't think about that. And the other is the powerful example set forth by Ernest Hemingway, who probably during 20s, 30s, and 40s, and maybe into the 50s, was probably the most looked-up-to writer by other writers, certainly the most influential so far as style is concerned. And everybody knew how much Papa drank day and night. And if he can do it and write this well, it behooves me to do just as well.
How could they do it? Well, how can they do it?
They tried to do it. Most of the American writers that I'm talking about burned themselves out very early. Now, people have often wondered, when I meet people in Europe, why is it your great American writers, by the end of the 30s, the beginning of their 40s, they are really finished? Whereas we have our Thomas Mann, we have our Tolstoy, who were writing in their 60s and 70s and beyond, for that matter. Whereas Hemingway, Faulkner, Fitzgerald are either dead or totally written out or committed suicide or something like that by the time they're 40. Now, some have lasted longer, but their later works, take people like Hemingway and Faulkner, their later works are a sad travesty of what they were able to accomplish before, say, 40.
A travesty, and yet better than almost anybody else could do. the nature of their genes.
Well, yeah, the fact is, the amazing thing about all of these writers is they were able, with all the drinking they did, how they could write anything at all, and they're to be commended for it. I mean, the idea of writing, well, I chose one particular thing, Faulkner's Absalom, Absalom, a book he wrote when he was under contract to 20th Century Fox, working 5.5 days a week in that place. At the same time, nursing unbelievable hangovers, because he drank very heavily every night, yet getting the screenplays done for Daryl Zanuck, and writing what is one of the great novels of the 20th century, which is a very difficult book to write, and still doing in the early dawn hours before he reported for work. And he did this day after day, week after week. Most of us could never even dream of doing anything like that.
So he wrote under hangover conditions.
Oh, yes. Most of these people did. What's the phrase from Hemingway? I think I include in the book there. I was nursing a mastodon hangover.
So they did their work in the early hours, presumably the early hours, yes. Even though they might or might not have a hangover, and then they would drink.
Right. Now, in the case of Fitzgerald, he, of all these writers, was the most vulnerable to alcohol. He passed out very, very quickly. He should never have drunk anything at all in his life. However, his talent departed him very early, and he just started grinding out commercial short stories. But eventually the editors stopped buying those stories because they became progressively weaker and weaker and weaker. The writer of the three major American writers here that I talk about, it was Faulkner that went on the longest, still producing absolutely first-rate material into his mid-40s. After that, he too shows a decline. But as you point out, even the work in decline is of interest.
But it's kind of interesting, you mentioned the question, how do they find time to do it? But often creative writing is done in bursts.
Oh, yes.
You know, they might have a burst of creativity, sure. And then a period where the work might be dormant, and they might go weeks or months, and then they could, nothing else to do. They could tie one on.
Depend on the writer. Hemingway made it the point. He wrote every day. There's always something to write. Of course, toward the end, when he found he could no longer write, could not literally place one word after another, killed himself. He really couldn't do that anymore. He really had to burn himself out profoundly. Of course, he had depression, psychic depression on top of alcoholism. Together, they make a killing combination.
Now, you point out in The Thirsty Muse that there are different types of alcoholism, and you mentioned Fitzgerald, one or two drinks would set him off.
Oh, absolutely, yes. I met a chap who knew him as early as about 1922, 23 at a football game, a man called Cox, and he met him, he was a reporter for the Newark Ledger, and they met in the locker room because Fitzgerald came around to congratulate the players, and Fitzgerald pulled out a flask. All it required is about two or three sips from him, and he was absolutely plastered. But he really could not hold his liquor at all. Whereas Faulkner and Hemingway both had unbelievable capacities for drink. Of course, toward the end, both of them required shock treatments. Both of them had to be hospitalized. But they did. They lasted until their 60s.
Must be something in the metabolism, huh?
Yes, Fitzgerald should not have had anything to drink ever at all. Everybody knows, but he always laughed at it. Because you see, as far as he was concerned, Fitzgerald, being able to hold your liquor well in large quantities was the definition of masculinity. Hemingway kept saying that. Any man who can't drink is not really a man. And Fitzgerald is a little worried. What does Ernest mean by that? I better start learning how to drink. He's always trying to master the art of drinking with predictably terrible results.
Yeah, I have one of my best friends. We always would get together for drinks and dinner, and still do. Mm-hmm. And at one point, he was trying to be a scotch drinker. two drinks of scotch, and that was it. He would, if it happened to be at my house, he would
collapse.
He would go to the bedroom and go to sleep. And he finally reached the conclusion that his metabolism was such that he could not drink hard liquor. He will drink wine or beer lightly.
Yes.
But for him to take scotch,
just
can't do it.
There are people who have built-in vulnerability. Now, for example, Asiatics who are faced with American hard spirits pass out cold on the spot the first drink or two. They master it after a while, but at first, the initial can't stand it at all.
I think the most harrowing chapter of the book deals with Faulkner. I had absolutely no idea how he could have abused his body in the way that he did, blackouts. And and how many times was he hospitalized?
I think it's either 18 or 19 times for at least a week at a time. Don't forget his remark to his publisher, Bennett Sir, who said, Bill, That's not a very nice way to spend your vacation. Bennett, it was my vacation. And Faulkner was not going to have anybody telling him it was bad for him. I think he just felt a life without liquor was a life not worth living.
But you also quote Faulkner in the book as saying, why am I doing this?
Well, that's when he would wind up in these hospitals. And the point is, he kept asking himself the question and never did get an answer. Never, never.
Now, there is another writer, Eugene O'Neill, who approached alcohol a little differently and wound up somewhat differently.
Well, he's my happy ending. That's why he comes last. He's the only one of these writers who, by the way, just at the critical age, just as he's getting close to 40 in his late 30s, is profoundly convinced that he's losing his talent. There's all the evidence there. His brother has died recently of it. His father had the disease, and his mother had it one way or another. The whole family had it. So he gave it up and went on in later years, after a hiatus in his career, to write what are his two best plays, Long Day's Journey into Night and The Iceman Cometh, both of which are concerned exclusively with addiction, the powers of addiction. So he is a happy ending in the sense that he was able to get that monkey off his back, partly, I think, through sheer willpower and partly because of a very early case of psychoanalysis, one of the first recorded cases where an American artist of any genuine significance actually went to a therapist, and among other things, the therapist said, you might just stop drinking, Gene. That might be a good idea.
And he did. Approximately what age did he stop?
38.
That was young.
Critical, funny age. That's the age when things start to go wrong with almost all of these people. 37, 38, 39, right in there. That's right across the board. Either they stop it, or the work starts to go down at that point.
Well, I noticed in your book, the alcoholic writers that you describe are all dead.
Oh, yes, they're all dead, as a matter of fact. Well, in the process of writing it, Carver was still alive.
Yes.
Although he did. Carver's story is very close to Eugene O'Neill's. He realized that he was writing nothing of any value, and he stopped. In the last 10 years of his life, which he claimed in that poem I quote of his, that these were his most creative years. And the minute he stopped drinking, everything went well for him.
He didn't, unfortunately, stop smoking. That's what.
No. See, if one thing doesn't get you, something else will.
Well, I had interviewed his widow, Tess Gallagher, who told me that after he gave up drinking, that was about the only addiction that he could give up. When it came to cigarettes, he could not stop, and it seemed that the cigarettes and the alcohol almost went together, and he just could not force himself to stop cigarette smoking. He didn't have the lungs for
it. Tragic.
He died of brain cancer, but the cancer was also in his lungs, and it spread throughout his body. He was only 50.
I know. Quite a shock, yes, because he was probably the best, most highly thought of among the, well, what are called younger American writers. He wasn't that young, but he was considered. I mean, his career blossomed very rapidly in the last 10 years of his life.
Oh, he became, in the mid-80s, probably the preeminent short story writer.
I think so. All the college anthologies, they have at least two of his stories these days. I mean, he's become a modern master.
Yeah, he had always wanted, I've interviewed him two or three times, he had always wanted to write a novel, been pushed toward that direction. And the last time I talked to him, I believe it was 1986, which may have been the year of his death, I'm not sure, maybe the year before.
No, he died in 88, I recall, yeah. It was 87.
Yeah, 87. It was not. He had undergone surgery, lung surgery. They had taken out a good portion of his lungs, but I didn't know he seemed all right when I interviewed him. He seemed fine. And he said that he'd been under enormous pressure to write a novel. But he indicated that he didn't think he ever would.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but that's all right. Mm-hmm. He said, you know, I do the best I can with what I have, in effect, and if I don't write a novel, that's...
Chekhov didn't write novels, right? So, Chekhov can get away with it, Carver could.
Now, you're teaching modern American literature.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, who are some of the modern writers that you teach? Carver, for example.
Well, the anthology that I use quite often has Carver, but when teaching modern American literature, it's usually the tried and true people, that is, Faulkner, Fitzgerald, Hemingway. All people like Nathaniel West, James Agee, Flannery O'Connor, certainly, who has become a cult standard. These are starting from 1920s to the present. These would be the writers. Anybody more recent than that? Well, I have a great fondness for Stanley Elkin.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's very good.
So do I.
And Carver, who I mentioned. Who else is particularly good today? Well, I'm running out of names.
there are so many, but there has to be kind of a test of time, doesn't there?
Oh, yes, indeed. Indeed, it does, yes.
Do you teach Mailer?
Well, ups and downs with Mailer. My enthusiasm for him has waxed and waned over the years.
He was at one time a very big drinker, I understand.
He may be. I don't know. No idea.
Yeah, he was a
No inside information about Norman
Mailer. A brawler. So was James Jones. He was.
Yes.
So was William Styron, who's still alive.
Yes.
Styron, in fact, publicly admitted in his last book of his that he abused alcohol most of his life.
Oh, yes. That's that book about his breakdown.
That's right.
Bestseller, yes.
With the modern writers, many of them are just doing short stories right now, and they're still to explode, perhaps, like Walter Kern, Bobby Ann Mason. I wish I had my list of many of these people I've
interviewed. Somebody like Madison Smart Bell, for example. He's another example of practicing young writer.
But I have a feeling that in the creative writing courses, the students read each other's work. They find mentors within their own group. And I have a feeling that some of them might think, well, Hemingway, he's passé. I mean, he was an influence on generations of writers, but he's not writing today. We need to explore new techniques.
Well, I find my students still quite enthralled with Ernest Hemingway, far more so than they are with Faulkner or Fitzgerald, because first of all, he's far more readable. He always was. You mustn't forget that Hemingway, right from the beginning of his career, was a critical success and a popular success. Not necessarily the case of most of these other writers. For example, nobody wanted to read Faulkner's books. Most of them were out of print during World War II. It was a big struggle to put Faulkner, of course, because of his difficulties in narrative. And Fitzgerald's career also went to a very, very bad
Fitzgerald,
career.
He seems so dated to me. Why did he have this resurgence? Why was there a resurgence of interest?
Well, there have been three waves about Fitzgerald and the revival of his reputation. One was just after the World War II. There was the Viking portable Fitzgerald that put it back on the map. But it's been these biographies more than anything else. There have been three of them, can't but you believe it, all of which became number one bestsellers.
Of course, he is a romantic figure.
Yeah, I mean, he represents the Jazz Age, the writer corrupted by American life, the man who was married to Zelda. She had her own book, Zelda. And I've often thought more myself that it's like Byron. The legend of the writer seems to be stronger than the actual works themselves. The Great Gatsby is a very notable short American work, but it's really not quite on the level of the Brothers Karamazov, as some people would have us believe. And however, people are interested in reading about him, and the students really seem to like the books. You can't deny that. That's true.
But you know, there were great, or extremely popular writers in the 20s and 30s that people don't seem to read. James Gould Cousins, for example. Does anybody read him today?
No. I think, despite the efforts of Professor Broccoli, his books are largely unread today. But that's true of so many writers in that period. Say, J.P. Marquand. It was unbelievably popular, both and critically, too. Nobody reads him at all anymore.
Sinclair Lewis won the Nobel Prize. I have a feeling that his stuff, of course, I haven't read him lately. I've read Main Street, and I read some of the early works of his.
Babbitt, probably. Yes.
Babbitt. Mm-hmm, yes. But I've seen some of the movies that were made from these films, and from these novels, and they are old, they're antiquated movies.
That's
and
right.
I just wonder if.
Well, you're quite right. I know a woman who shares in the royalties. He left her some of his estate. But every time the royalty reports come through, they're always less and less. Each year as they go on.
Of course, there could be a resurgence that often happens.
There have been resurgences of people, but sometimes even those don't work. For example, 30, 40 years ago, they tried to revive William Dean Howells with no particular success. And I think somebody may try this with Lewis, but I doubt it. They did try it, actually, about 20 years ago. Didn't work very well. None of the publishers put out the major books, and they didn't exactly sit there, but they did not move very rapidly.
What about Dreiser?
Dreiser is one of those very peculiar writers. Nobody reads anything of Dreiser. In fact, the amazingly large number of books he wrote, except Sister Carrie and American Tragedy. And Sister Carrie, I think, is a notable novel, and students like that. The other book, I've got into furious arguments with people. I think it's a long, dull, stupid book, American Tragedy. but they are still being widely read. It's mainly on historical grounds. I think American students would have trouble plowing through an American tragedy today.
Well, there again is the dating factor, although it could be updated very easily. I mean, it's a story of a murder.
Yeah.
And a love affair, a love triangle.
It was revived for that very successful movie of the 50s with Elizabeth Taylor and Montgomery Clift, A Place in the Sun.
Right.
So you can take it, you can sort of warm up the ingredients. Yes. Get Shelley Winters as the victim.
And I remember reading Frank Norris.
Yes.
His stuff is harrowing, absolutely harrowing.
Yes.
Going even further up, the historical novelist McKinley Cantor, he was great.
Yes.
Andersonville, Spirit Lake.
I think what you're getting at is that in America we forget our writers very rapidly. Yeah. We run through them at a fast rate, usually within 10 years after their death. Who was that? And it's very difficult to do that because new people are always coming along. However, the writers I've chosen to write about here, I think, are holding their own pretty well, by and large.
Yeah, these are really fixtures. What about, of course, you teach in an academic setting.
Yes.
You obviously surround yourself with writers to a degree.
Well, I see in the publishing business,
yeah.
So I got to know.
What is the state of writers and alcoholism today?
Well, a lot of writers switch from alcohol to various other controlled substances, as they call it, namely marijuana, cocaine, and one thing or another. However, I think writers are drinking as heavily now as they did.
They are?
Yeah, as they did in the past. I talked to Tess Gallagher about this connection with her husband's work, and she says she teaches creative writing all over the United States in many colleges, and she finds many of her students, says at least half of them, are quite convinced, having read all of these writers that I write about here, that one sure way to success is to be able to hold a lot of liquor. And she goes around trying to disabuse them of this notion. So there's a myth in American writing that alcohol and creativity are linked together forever. One of the tasks of this job, one of the purposes of this book, is to change people's minds about this.
Well, that's very interesting. William Styron was sitting in that same seat.
He was.
A few years ago.
Yes.
And we were talking about the same topic.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he told me, before we left the interview, by the way, we went to the bar across the street and I bought mm-hmm. him a couple of scotches.
Yeah, very nice. Mm-hmm.
But he told me that he enjoyed alcohol and that it enhanced the creative process.
Mm-hmm.
And
you sent him a copy of The Thirsty Muse. See how
he
responds.
Yeah. Well, I don't believe he believes that now.
I mean, yeah, he changed his mind.
I have that impression because he, as we mentioned before in our chat, has stated publicly that he did abuse alcohol.
Yes.
But he liked it. For some reason, he would put music on the turntable and sit by his typewriter, and it got his adrenaline flowing, and he began to write. Images would flow, and he felt that this was good and an enhancement for his creative power.
It's very similar to what Faulkner felt. I went on my way here in the book to indicate something that some people may be misinformed about. It's not that Faulkner was roaring drunk when he wrote his books. It's that Faulkner would have a tumblerful, say, of gin or whatever it may be, or bourbon more likely, and just gradually, you know, slowly take sips from it. Also had music on. He used to play Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue over and over again until he wore out the record and put him in the mood, and he would sit away, pecking away at his typewriter. And this went on all day long. He was never without alcohol. On the other hand, he was never demonstrably drunk. He was, if you will, elevated, in an elevated creative mood, so he felt. And apparently it did work wonders for these writers, or at least they thought it was working wonders, up until this mysterious time, late 30s, where the hangovers get worse, the DTs begin, the hospitalizations begin, the drying out periods, all the horrors begin about that age. And most of all, of course, to a writer, the fact they can no longer write as well as they could in the past, no matter what the reviewers said. Reviewers, for example, were very kindly to John Steinbeck in his last years.
Yeah,
John Steinbeck was no fool. He knew exactly how badly his books had.
He was a very heavy drinker. In fact, his widow, Elaine, who told me that when he was summoned to Norway to pick up the Nobel Prize, he entered into a pact with Elaine. He said, "You make a deal with me. When we go to Norway to pick the prize, will you and I not drink? I won't drink, and you watch me. You won't drink." because I want to be the best representative I can for the United States.
That's nice.
And he did not drink while he was there. Mm-hmm. I don't know that he was an alcoholic, but as Elaine said, he would really pack it away.
Well, he seems to have all the characteristics. Yes, indeed.
Well, I also I have this feeling, this is not borne out with any statistics or anything, that drinking and drug use, these are young people's games to a degree. When you get older, you're... If it hasn't killed you when you get older, somehow you lose interest, or you go on to other things.
Up to a point, Ernest Hemingway would not have agreed with you. You know, in other words, John Steinbeck, for that matter. And they did live into their 60s, and they still were drinking phenomenal amounts.
In their 60s, though, but that's pretty young to go.
Well, perhaps so, yes.
But
yes.
Pretty young. Well, it's a fascinating subject and scary, too, in a way.
Oh, yes. Some people get rather defensive. Jay McInerney reviewed this book for the London Times Literary Supplement, and he really felt, apparently, in his review, that I was really out to get F. Scott Fitzgerald. So he drummed up all kinds of arguments to show there really wasn't any falling off of his talent at all. There's every indication that The Last Tycoon, for example, published posthumously, might have been just as great as The Great Gatsby. Very few people would agree with him on that. No.
Well, it might have been, had he finished it.
Well, we only know what we have.
That's right.
That's the point. And it doesn't shape up as well as what we had in the past, I think. That's my opinion. But we'll see. In other words, there is a protective thing. You know, some people felt, for example, some of my colleagues at school, do you really think you should be writing a book on that like this that spills the beans, so to speak, on our great American writers? Won't it give the reasons, give the students reasons to suppose, why are we reading about the reading books by these authors? Aren't they just a bunch of drunks? You see, it's a question here. The point is, you have to face the fact, yes, they were a bunch of drunks, absolutely, unequivocally. Nevertheless, despite this handicap, they wrote these absolutely fantastic books that we read and reread. They all had the monkey on their back, but they did remarkably well.
Fascinating, Tom Dardis. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Good.